I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's such a pleasure to welcome you to the first headliners of this season. I've looked forward to these, missed them all summer, and it's very nice to see so many familiar faces from last year as well. For those of you who may be joining us tonight for the first time, Headliners is a monthly gathering for engaged citizens who are interested in discussing topical issues with university faculty whose expertise illuminates stories in the headlines or whose research is making national news. The first two headliners of the year demonstrate the diversity of topics this series covers, from tonight's examination of the 35W bridge collapse to next month when astronomy professor Larry Rudnick will share his discovery of an enormous hole in the universe. So we hope you'll join us on the first Thursday of the month for these fascinating and wide-ranging discussions. As always, we're also looking to you to shape the conversations with your great questions and comments. As you can see, we're taping tonight's presentation and we'll be posting the audio on our website. Over the past year, hundreds of people have downloaded these talks from all over the world. So this year we've added a blog to the Headliners website to enable us to continue the discussion of each month's topic online. We hope you'll add your thoughts there as well. Perhaps we'll even get an international dialogue going with some of those folks listening from around the world. Last August, the shocking collapse of the I-35W bridge defied comprehension or easy resolution. Senator Amy Klobuchar may have said it best when she observed that a bridge in America shouldn't just fall down. While we don't know the specific reason for the structural failures and may not for many months, it's important to understand the decisions and policies that may have contributed to this disaster and to ensure that it never, ever happens again. Understanding urban change and development is the mission of the newly formed University Metropolitan Consortium, which tonight's speaker, John Adams, co-chairs, along with Professor Judith Martin. Judith is also with us this evening. Judith, would you mind standing? There she is. Thanks for coming tonight. These urban scholars are in a unique position to help us sort through the complicated economic, social, and political issues surrounding this awful Minnesota tragedy. John Adams is chair of the University of Minnesota's Geography Department, as well as a core faculty member in the Master of Urban and Regional Planning program at the Humphrey Institute. For the past 30 years, he has studied how large metropolitan areas function and evolve. He has written more than 100 books, articles, and reports on the American city, housing markets, and urban transportation systems, including Minneapolis-St. Paul, People, Place, and Public Life, The Path of Urban Decline, and the four-volume Contemporary Metropolitan America. Before joining the faculty in 1970, Professor Adams received a master's degree in economics and a PhD in urban economic geography from the University of Minnesota. Will you please join me in welcoming Professor John Adams.
Thanks very much, Mary. I have to revise my canned introduction. I managed to shed my chairmanship 2 years ago and retired officially last January, and when the word got out that I was retired, people came after me and gave me new jobs. It just can't seem to get away. But this is a very nice occasion to start my long weekend. I'm one of those weird university professors who has kids who are in the Army. And my Lieutenant Colonel's son, who's teaching at Leavenworth, after he came back from Iraq, is coming up tonight with his kids. So we can go fishing tomorrow. So I think that's a good thing to do. And my wife would be here, but she's down at Fort Stewart, Georgia, where my daughter Ellen is a lieutenant colonel, the deputy commander of the base down at Fort Stewart, where the 3rd Infantry Division is headquartered. They're the big component of the surge that you've heard so much about. Her husband's over in Iraq right now. So this is a tough time for people who are close to these events, and I'm sure there are many people in the room here who not only have friends and relatives who are involved in all of this stuff, but for those of you who are a little bit older, probably some of the stuff that's been on Channel 2 the last few weeks or a week have certainly jogged many memories. So in the light of all of that, I'm glad to be here. It's stopped teaching a year ago and don't often have a chance to see people in this kind of a context. But I was told that this is a really smart, opinionated, aggressive group of people, and they are people who have better things to do than watch primetime television on Thursday night, so we're in good company here. So thank you and welcome to the university. So bridges shouldn't fall down. So why do they? Back in the 1950s, an old geography professor at Berkeley published an article titled 20th Century Magic. His basic argument was that our everyday experience teaches us that cause and effect occur at the same time and place. Well, your mother tells you, don't touch the stove, it's hot. So, of course, we touch it, and it's hot, we get burned. If you grow up here in Minnesota, mother tells you when you're out in the park in January, whatever you do, don't touch your tongue onto the chain of the swing. So all the natives laugh here. So we do, and our tongue sticks to the chain, and we rip it off, and then we cry, and then we learn. Well, 20th century magic seduces us into thinking that if something we don't like is happening at a time and a place, we should provide a remedy at that time, at that place. For example, people run red lights and cause accidents. So if we install photocops and mail a scofflaw ticket, drivers will behave better. So we did, and they did, and accidents dropped. Other things happened after that, but that's a separate story. Now, right now, there's a campaign in Minneapolis to add 50 more beat cops. It's 20th century magic. But this approach usually leads to treating symptoms of problems rather than the source of the problem. So let's think about this cause and effect business in a different way. Some of us are old enough to remember the celebrated case of diethyl stilbestrol, or DES, which was synthesized in 1938. And for 30 years, from the 40s through the 60s, it was prescribed to 5 to 10 million women. One of its uses was to prevent miscarriages. But by the 1970s, it was discovered that it led to cancer in the female children of many of the women who had taken the drug. And I'm sure there are people in the room who remember that case. So, different time, different place, cause and effect separated widely. We can think of other examples, mine tailings in Lake Superior, asbestos, thalidomide, and so forth. Looking for cause and effect. So what on earth does looking for causes and effects have to do with bridges falling down? Well, think about it. Think of all the finger pointing after the collapse. Did the inspectors do their job? Did we skimp on maintenance? Was there a design flaw? Were we using the bridge in ways that were not anticipated? Was the equipment used by the bridge repair crew too heavy? Was the MnDOT commissioner asleep at the switch? Was the bridge design defective, and so forth? People want answers, but they have a hard time thinking about cause and effect separated in time and space, and they also have difficulty thinking about complex systems. Take some other examples. Cruising of cars downtown. It's been discovered that a big share of downtown traffic consists of people, drivers, cruising the streets while looking for a parking space at the curb. Off-street parking is available, but you have to pay the market price for it. If off-street parking is expensive compared with underpriced meter parking or free curb parking, cruising is a rational response. So by underpricing curb parking, cities create an unintended traffic congestion by providing an economic incentive to cruise. In New York, the price of off-street parking a year ago was average $14.50 for the first hour, while the meter price was $1.50. Now, if curb parking were priced right, there would be about 1 out of 8 spaces free at any one time. There would be no cruising. Average search time would be 0, and the amount of traffic on the downtown street would drop sharply. Hurricanes. Take another example, hurricane damage. After Hurricane Andrew,
The Category 5 storm with sustained winds of 175 miles an hour came ashore in South Miami in 1992. It caused more than $26 billion in damage. The next year, my State Farm house insurance premium jumped by more than 20%. So I called my insurance guy and I said, okay, what's going on here? He said, well, it's because of the hurricanes in South Florida. And I said, I don't live in South Florida. I live in Minnesota. We don't have hurricanes here. If people choose to live in South Florida, then they should pay for the risks they accept when they live in the path of hurricanes. His reply was that the Florida State Insurance Commissioner would not let State Farm raise the rates for properties in hazardous areas. Later, State Farm decided to stop writing coverage in South Florida, and the hue and cry that arose forced the commissioner to relent, and the property owners bellyached at the high premiums they had to pay. The fallout from Katrina is even worse, and it continues. Well, we can think of lots of examples here, but well, what's the point of the examples? The point is, in a complex system like ours, people should pay for what they get, and individually and as a society, we should receive value for what we pay for. That's sort of my mantra on these public policy issues. People should pay for what they get, and alternatively, they should receive value for what they pay. What's wrong? Why did the bridge fall down? I don't know. But I do know that there are serious defects in our contemporary economy that lead to system failure, and the bridge falling down is but a recent and vivid example. Consider mercenaries in Iraq to make up for deficient troop numbers. Consider the dollar falling in value compared with the euro and the Canadian dollar. Rising in value against the dollar is another example. The strike at GM is another example. The bridge. My third example is the bridge itself. One transportation specialist here in town recalled that in the 1960s, when the bridge was built, the highway industry still followed the standards that were used in building the New Jersey Turnpike, and that road, in turn, was built to the same standards as the Pennsylvania Turnpike, which opened in the 1950s. It, at that time, set maximum truck loads at 40,000 pounds, maximum truck speed, 50 miles an hour. Guess what? Today, we run trucks 80,000 pounds. The trucks run at 65 miles an hour or more on these same roads and bridges. In other words, the shippers, the truckers, and their customers are getting services, but they're not paying the full price for the services that they're receiving. We have a defective economy and a defective political economy in these matters. Let's back up a bit and outline some broad trends in our American economy and consider what's happening to our competitive position with regard to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. When we use the word the economy, the way we learned it in college, we normally think about the production of goods, the distribution of goods and services, and the consumption of goods and services. Okay, so what? Well, American society seems increasingly immersed in a relentless trend toward a consumption-oriented, lifestyle-oriented economy. We focus on cheap goods, personal services, especially if we can get someone else to pay for them, like health insurance and health care. In fact, as a nation, some critics claim that we've become so addicted to cheap goods and cheap services and to third-party payment schemes that it's undermined healthy relations with China, Pakistan, India, the oil-exporting countries, our energy policy, the immigration debate, and its efforts to resolve the American health care problem. Well, is this a helpful observation or is it a bum rap? Well, let's think about that for a minute. Beginning in the 1930s, up through the post-World War II period, it seems that our American economy was devoted essentially to production for our own use. The American economy was essentially a closed economy. We produced what we consumed. We consumed what we produced. In the 1950s, half the workforce was in manufacturing, mining, construction, and transportation. Now it's below 30% in those areas and dropping. Meanwhile, the number of and share of workers in consumption and entertainment has skyrocketed, and not just for the moneyed leisure class, but for just about everyone else. But again, is that a problem? Well, it depends on how you look at it. Andrew Young, the former mayor of Atlanta and former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, recently went to work doing public relations for Walmart. He said that for all of its negative press, that company has made it possible for people of modest means to enjoy more of the goodies that middle-class Americans have enjoyed, and he thinks that's okay, even if they're cheap knockoffs of expensive labels. So now we have more people working in retail trade than in manufacturing. But in this drive toward a consumption-focused economy where we're maximizing throughput, the problem isn't that people are getting things they want. That's understandable, and that's good. It's even spawned the mini storage industry. We have so much junk, we run out of space to store it. The problem is that there's a hidden downside. Think of it this way. Income is cash flow. Wealth is assets. You can have income without assets and vice versa. But not everybody understands that. Jay Leno, in one of his interviews on the street, asked a girl, "What's your main source of income?" The girl giggled and replied, "Visa." You know, see, that's funny, it is. But and we laugh, but of course it's serious. Spending money you don't have, whether you're a family or a state government, we call that accumulating debt, which is a liability, which is the opposite of an asset. It's one thing to go into debt to produce an asset that returns annual payoffs, like a machine in a factory or your house. But from a national perspective, in the minds of many observers, we're not going into debt to build a stronger asset base. Instead, we're drawing down American and world assets to support cash flow and to support consumption. That's the hidden downside. So, coming back to specifics, we need to ask, who's paying the long-term tab for those casks of nuclear waste that are piling up? They represent one liability on our balance sheet. Where will we park and dump the garbage barges that float off the East Coast, where we've run out of solid waste disposal sites? The quality of the ocean asset diminishes when we dump that stuff out beyond the continental shelf. Or when will we run out of solid waste disposal sites? What's the cost to Minnesota of those contaminated aquifers on the east side of the Twin Cities that came about from leakage from 3M's waste disposal sites? Or when will we stop putting fertilizer and sewage residue into our surface waters, which impairs our lakes and streams and reduces their value? Or when will we curtail putting mercury into the environment and into the bodies of little kids? Or when will ice cap melting and rising sea levels eventually inundate much of coastal Florida and Mississippi and Louisiana and parts of California? And what will be lost from our national balance sheet? We can't even get our arms around the $150 billion damage from Katrina, and that's small potatoes compared with other deterioration of our national assets. The point is that environmental assets on our national and international balance sheets are being drawn down in order to maintain ever larger annual cash flows for consumption. I include here the natural environment and the built environment. I see the bridge falling down as one more example of the drawing down of an asset in order to sustain cash flow for consumption. In other words, people are increasingly unwilling to pay for the benefits that they receive. Now, I concede that there are philosophical debates about how we should use and use up natural environments. Think of old growth forests. Think of depleted aquifers in the West that are used for irrigation. Think of invasive species on land or surface waters. These are assets that are deteriorating. Some people feel that those assets are there for the taking, while others feel we have no right to take them away from future generations. So to summarize, we need to price things right, and we need to pay for what we get. And we need to distinguish between income on the one hand and wealth on the other. That's the difference between cash flow and assets. When we talk about income and outgo, and about earning and spending, The big question that emerges is, can we as a state or as a country continue behaving as we now behave, or is there a dark cloud emerging over the horizon? In working with my students, I've introduced the idea of a balance sheet for the state of Minnesota, talking about our assets, about our liabilities, and how a balance sheet differs from an annual profit and loss statement. Let me show you an example. Anyone in the business world understands the difference. Most households understand the concept of their net worth. So regardless of the philosophical debates over the value and the proper use of natural resources, my balance sheet metaphor turns out to be a useful one for talking about the trade-offs between maintaining cash flow versus building up or drawing down assets. When I use this idea with students, even though most of them are broke and in debt, it's given them a new way to talk about economic activity and the long-term impact on the environment, on our national wealth, and on our future competitive position in the world. It changes the way we talk about revenues and outlays, whether at home or by government at every level. In a business, in our household, or in our state, we need to invest in assets in order to create a flow of future benefits or to reduce future obligations. That's why we educate and train our kids so that they don't graduate from college and come home and live in the basement playing their guitar. That's why we vaccinate the kids when they're small to ward off illness in the future. That's why we build flood protection walls and river levees. That's why business owners will tell you that at the end of the year, they evaluate the company's performance by looking at not one, but two financial statements, an annual profit and loss statement and a balance sheet. If they've had a profitable year, the balance sheet's been strengthened, which improves the company's prospects for the years ahead. If the company's had a bad year, they've drawn down assets, and the balance sheet has weakened. If they draw them down enough, we call that bankruptcy. Turns out we lack any reasonable approximation of a genuine profit and loss statement for our region, and we certainly lack a comprehensive balance sheet for our country, for our planning regions, for our Twin Cities, for the state of Minnesota. Since we lack any kind of a balance sheet to check up on how we're doing as a state, our attention is drawn to the short-term income-outgo business. That's what the legislature haggles over every year, the income and the outgo, pushing into the background the discussion of what it means long-term in terms of the state's balance sheet. To the extent that we focus disproportionately on sources of revenues and on spending, without a clear sense of the difference between spending and investing, and how it all adds up over the long term, it makes sense to scrimp on the budget for the DNR and watch Minnesota's waters increasingly impaired, or to cut back on enforcement of environmental rules and see increasing intrusions into fragile wetlands, or to defer maintenance on Minnesota's roads and bridges, or to sell off old growth forests and other environmental assets to balance the annual budget. There's a discussion some of you probably know about what to do about all that Great Lakes water that we're not making any use of. Why not ship it to Arizona? Do what the Soviets tried to do in Central Asia. We read in Business Week last spring that the city of Chicago and states like Pennsylvania, Indiana, New Jersey are leasing or selling off some of their highways to private companies to get upfront cash to balance their budgets and provide cash for new ventures. Minneapolis is selling its municipal parking ramps for some of the same reasons. Now, we can argue about public goods and whether the government should be in the parking ramp business or the highway business, but these plans to sell public assets have more to do with short-term policies and budget issues than they have to do with philosophy, and they appear to have nothing to do with the need to strengthen the state's balance sheet. Instead, it's like the household selling the refrigerator to pay the rent. The cash keeps flowing, but the balance sheet takes a hit. So how did we get into this way of thinking about state finances? Well, the story is pretty interesting, and here's my own hypothesis, although I ran it by Art Rolnick at the Fed, and he didn't argue with me. I never heard anybody quite put it this way. It began during the Depression years of the 1930s when our country had enormous assets. We had great farms. We had good new factories. We had a healthy, energetic, immigrant, and native-born workforce. We had new highways, new railroads, effective schools for the day. We had a very good national communication system. So what was wrong? Well, it was decided by the mid-30s that consumer incomes and outlooks were inadequate to crank up the economy to its full performance. So FDR's economists devised the concept of the gross national product, the GNP model, which is based on flows, mainly consumption, investment, and government spending, because the stocks or the assets were in very good shape. They were in good shape, so we could take them for granted and worry about the flows. Programs like WPA and the CCC were inaugurated to put cash into unemployed workers' pockets. Today, seven decades later, we still think in GNP or flow terms and take the stocks, that is the assets, for granted even when we shouldn't. And this is risky. So at present, it seems to me, we're drawing down assets in order to sustain the flows, and that weakens our state's economy and our competitive position. Incidentally, speaking of competitive position, Minnesota was 19th in population size in 1970. It's 20th today. There's a good possibility we will lose a congressional seat after Census 2010. On the other hand, we were 10th in per capita income and 9th in 2005. But the Census Bureau and other federal agencies don't report anything that would look like a balance sheet for our state. They report the flows. Income is a flow measure. What about our state's asset position compared with other states and other metro regions? Are we building them up? Are we drawing them down? And what about assets and cash flow in specific regions across Minnesota and the neighborhoods and cities of the Twin Cities area? Where do they fit into the state averages on both measures? Some subregions of Minnesota have to confront steady population losses, the closing up of businesses, the consolidation of farms, the outmigration of young people who see no good future for them if they stick around. Others have the opposite problem, things growing faster than is comfortable, and that's a different challenge. How to accommodate growth without destroying the valuable assets in the process? If businesses worried about cash flow only and ignored the balance sheet, it would pay attention only to its sales and not at the rest of the picture. It might sell factory equipment or other assets to pay salaries. If a household behaved that way, as I said earlier, it might take a home equity loan and spend a month in Las Vegas or sell a refrigerator to pay the rent or max out the credit cards. Measures like these would maintain cash flow for sure, but they'd eventually wreck the balance sheet. So we're immersed in a consumption economy that's somewhat out of whack because we focus exclusively or at least excessively on the flows, without sufficient regard to their effects on the national balance sheet assets, that is, the stocks that make the flows possible. The major assets of our state and its subregions include well-educated, well-trained, healthy, informed, and law-abiding citizens. They include healthy, competitive businesses. You can go back to the previous one to be reminded. They include effective and efficient schools, colleges, and universities. They include our many governments, state, counties, cities, townships, special districts. They include our institutions and our foundations. They include our built environment and all aspects of infrastructure, such as roads and bridges. And, of course, our outstanding natural environments. Now, what about the liabilities on the state's balance sheet? Among other things, we would include troubled and unhealthy families and kids. We would include impaired lakes and streams, unfunded pensions, and other public and private liabilities and IOUs. And they would include unmet needs and deferred maintenance on our highways and transit systems. And I'm sure each of you could add to the list. The main point of this is to distinguish between our state's asset base on the one hand and the way we manage our cash flow on the other. The big question remains, are we building up our asset base or drawing it down? Whether we talk about human capital, the built environment, the natural environment, or our crucial institutions. At bottom is the need for planning for the long term, whether we're a family, whether we're a household, a region, a state. We won't get far by selling or drawing down assets to pay this year's bills, and we won't solve the state's fiscal problems by neglecting maintenance. Depreciation of physical assets is real, whether it's the roof over our heads or the deterioration of the thousands of highway overpasses that are aging and crumbling before our eyes. The interstate Highways and bridges were built to last an average of 30 years. We started building them in the 50s. Do the math. An especially egregious example of overlooking assets and liabilities is the public pension problem across the country and here in Minnesota. There are too many units of government that, by any reasonable accounting standard, are bankrupt, which means that their legal liabilities exceed their assets. So as I said, the essence of this argument is the need for improved comprehensive planning and honest budgeting, long-term, even though the word planning can carry some baggage from the Cold War days, and it triggers negative reactions in some quarters. Paying for what we get while making sure that we get what we pay for, that's the key. So the bridge fell down, but sales at the Mall of America are up. So what's wrong with this picture? Thank you. Stunned silence falls over the room.
As we reach for the mic here, John.
Who's jumping in first?
I'm speechless.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to ask, we've got three mics floating around the room here. I'm going to ask you all as you ask a question to use the mic so that we can hear you both in the room but also online. So where do you want to start? Let's go over here.
You can't be the only person who has recognized this, and there must be some, you know, they're economists, they're politicians, et cetera, who understand it. How does the country, state, city develop the political leadership to get the population to recognize the issue so that it's possible at least to start to support a change in how we focus and how we spend our money to invest in infrastructure in the broadest sense of the word?
I wish I knew. I've spent 40 years in the classroom trying to figure out how things work and trying to instill in young people a new understanding or a deeper understanding of how things work, and by word and by example, encouraging them to get involved in these things and learn by doing as well as learn by watching and by studying. I have a great faith that somewhere along the line education does make a difference. But it is true that those who occupy the bully pulpits, and I don't think a classroom teacher has the same level of impact in the bully pulpit that a governor or a president can have, but that would be one way to do it. People get trained to think in certain ways, and those they listen to have a lot of influence. Parents and teachers generally have more influence than they believe they do, but it's often not by what they say, but the example that they set. That's about all I can say about that, but I share your sentiment.
Maybe I'm asking the same question a little differently, and our politicians are elected by us, so I don't blame them. I'm wondering it seems to me the change starts with us. And what are your suggestions on that end?
I certainly can't argue with that. I spend a lot of time with the Citizens League as well, and one of their major projects right now is to figure out ways to engage people more in understanding and doing things that influence not only their own lives, but the lives of those who will come behind them. The trouble is we're kind of surrounded by a culture that discourages that kind of thinking. And cultures just exist, and they have influence on the way we shape our outlooks and our behaviors. And then there are countervailing cultures. If you saw, as I saw some of it, although I hardly ever watch TV, my wife says, you really got to see this. So I went and watched some of the episodes of the war that went on this week. There's nothing like television with no commercials, but I don't see much of that. But I remember very vividly how we behaved and thought and acted during the war when the whole country was engaged in an effort with leadership from the top. And since that time, of course, people did disperse, and our consumer culture is very oriented toward what I want to do without regard to a lot of what's going on around. I don't know the answer to that question. Lots of people are worrying about this. I do believe, though, that leadership does have a role here. I'm just not sure how you trigger the kind of leadership that would work against what it is that people feel in their bones they really want to do. I don't know the answer. Wish I did.
We have a question back here.
I think this is another iteration of the same situation, but our ethos today, our general discussion of politics, taxes has become anathema. A tax is like a sin that you're stealing from your pocket. Somehow we have to convince people that a tax is really an investment in our future, and I don't know how we change that dialogue.
I think I'd give the same answer again. Oliver Wendell Holmes said that taxes are the price we pay for civilization, and I agree. I talk to my kids about this stuff, and not a single one of them has any problem with paying taxes. They look at it from the other side, the second part of my little aphorism, which was, make sure you get what you pay for. Don't worry about, you know, the price, worry about the value. And if you understand how the world works, which most people don't, because for some reason we don't teach people in school these days modern history and geography of our country that would allow them to put the pieces together in a whole picture and see how this affects that and why we are the way we are. If we don't do that, then we shouldn't be surprised if they allow themselves to be led by people who say that, you know, the price of civilization isn't worth paying.
Yes, I'm just thinking in terms of looking at the list of assets and liabilities, and it would seem that the idea of paying taxes seems a great part of that problem is that there's a conflict over what that common good should be, and maybe that's where the largest problem lies, that all individuals have a different idea of what is the important common good. And
that's true.
So if you're looking at bridges or pensions or, you know, what becomes the important common good that should be focused on, and maybe that's why people can't come together.
If they focus on their differences without some kind of a countervailing argument that gets them out of their own personal view and allows them to think in broader terms about the trade-off between what's good for them and what's good for someone else, then you've got a problem. But that used to be what politics was all about. Politics is the people's business, and if it's run properly, if you look at something like the General Motors strike, for instance, there are many sides to that issue. Most people aren't able to talk about all of the sides because they either ignore it completely or pay attention to one part of it, whether they're involved in it or not, when actually it's an extremely complicated question, very complicated question. The business about selling the roads is a complicated question. Should the city, should the township, should the town or county or state be in the road business? Some things we do because we've always done them. And in the minds of many people, what's familiar is necessary. If you grow up in a family where people hit each other, you think that's normal until you go over to the friend's house and discover they don't do that. And then there's a question in your mind if you have, you know, a full deck upstairs and are thinking about things. If what's familiar seems necessary and no one challenges that with an alternative view, I mean, that's why we go to school. That's why we try to teach people to think critically. You sit in a classroom with a bunch of students and you'll throw out a question and you get six different answers, and then you sit there and examine the answers. And in the process of examining it, kids should learn to think better, and they should also learn that there's different views out there. But if nobody pays attention to this stuff and someone who does occupy the bully pulpit says something and nobody argues back publicly, then, of course, thinking gets shaped in a direction that doesn't necessarily help us all. But it does require these days an awful lot of understanding about how things work, and it does require that you be in a place where you can say and do things that are going to make a difference. It doesn't do any good to bellyache across the breakfast table to your partner about what's going on if it never goes any further than that. But the fact that you folks are here asking questions suggests that maybe you have at least some interest in learning more and doing more. That's what we do at the classroom, and this is, in effect, a public classroom. Other comments, questions?
Back here, Margie.
There are debates over what are public assets and what are private assets, but there are also things that are in the middle. Neighborhoods are made up of sometimes public housing and public buildings and private housing and private buildings, but the neighborhood itself is seen as a public asset. And so I'm wondering how you get a community to figure out about that murky stuff in the middle that really does create a community that is a public asset.
I suppose you do it by doing it, engaging in the debate. And in different parts of the country, with a highly diverse nation, you're going to come out with different answers in different places. For example, in some work we did at the Citizens League many years ago, we sharpened up the distinction between the provision of a public good and the production of a public good. In other words, governments are responsible for making sure something is provided. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the government needs to do it. And that's what's led to a certain number of cases where we contract out certain work, because it's decided that either there's no reason why public employees should be doing it, or because it isn't being done the way we want it done, and we have a hard time directing outcomes the way we'd like to see them as a community. In other places, they come up with a different answer. It depends. But it's a legitimate debate. Should we be in the parking ramp business or not? There's room for argument about what's best for Minneapolis, what's best for St. Paul, what's best for New York. I think that these issues should be resolved through thoughtful debate. In some parts of the world recently, you may know of examples where they've decided to privatize public water systems. It's turned out to be, in the cases I'm aware of, a complete disaster. Clean water is a public good that can be provided, in some cases, best if it's carefully done by a public agency, or it can be done by a private company, provided there's the right kind of supervision and tight controls on what goes on. Some of these things, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, we shouldn't be in this business, let somebody else do it. You let somebody else do it and don't manage it well, you've got a problem. Alternatively, if you say this has to be done by the city or by the county or by the whatever, sometimes that leads to other kinds of defects. Public debate and local politics is the way these things should be solved. I don't think that, with the exception probably of international relations and military defense, and probably the management of the money supply, there are relatively few things that the country must do on its own. Many things in this country we've learned that states can do very well, thank you, and sometimes states turn over to local governments, home rule charters that allow the cities to manage their own affairs within the rules set by the state. So there's lots of answers to that question, and I don't subscribe to any one solution. I have to know more and then encourage people to resolve these things at the local level. One thing I do find fault with, however, is people who show up in places that provide opportunity, and then the people who show up to take advantage of those opportunities fall into a pattern of thinking that says, we get to take, but we don't have to contribute. In other words, we get to move out to this particular suburb and take advantage of all the subsidies, but don't ask us to pay the price for what we're getting. And then on the other end, we've got systems in place, as I suggested earlier, where, you know, I went to high school with fellows at De La Salle in downtown Minneapolis who went to work for the city at age 19 and then retired 20 years later when they were 39 years old and are still drawing pensions. I told them then, and I'll tell them now when I see them playing golf or whatever, that this isn't right. There's something wrong here. I understand how it happened and why it happened, but that's not a bargain that a public that's aware of what's going on should be willing to accept categorically. It represents getting something and not returning a benefit of equal value.
I'd like to introduce religion into this conversation.
Good.
Because Tim LaHaye and his partners have sold how many million books in the Left Behind series that some people feel they're going to be raptured up into heaven, and so they don't really have any concern about what our world is going to be like for the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren that are going to have to pay all these debts.
Well, I don't know that's necessarily an outcome of a religious sentiment. It might be the other way around, that the attitude that is expressed gets some kind of cover from subscribing to that particular theology. I do know that some theologies I'm familiar with suggest that you ought to be paying attention to the people alongside of you and not be concerned only with yourself. I mean, a serious Jew, a serious Christian, a serious Muslim is aware of the community that they're part of and incurs some obligation to worry about them. at least at present. Now, what happens next, that's going to be some difference of opinion about responsibilities down the road. But when I was on the council of our parish in Southwest Minneapolis, I remember once when it was time to remodel the church. It was 50 years old, and it was getting kind of tattered. Somebody on the council said, well, look, why do we have to do that? What's wrong with the church? So I said, look, in 1938, 39, 40, people who are long dead paid for the church you're now using. Now it's your turn to pay for the church that somebody's going to be using 20 years from today. And he looked at me and he said, I never thought about it that way. Okay. Some people don't think about it until you remind them. But you inherit something, whether it's a built environment, a natural environment, an institution, and you use it. Some people would think that there ought to be more of a quid pro quo in life, that you shouldn't just rip it off, you should pay your dues. Now, I realize that's a specific view and not everybody subscribes to it. I happen to subscribe to it. If you're healthy and you're lucky, take care of people who aren't. That's an attitude that grows out of many traditions and many religious views. Wherever it comes from, though, it makes sense. It leads to a healthier community. It's like the question that was raised earlier about down at the neighborhood level, when you're all there together, what should you do about it? Get together and tackle questions at the scale at which it's appropriate to tackle them. And everybody, both who's there now and who will follow, is going to be better off. I don't think, and that's not rocket science, it seems like common sense, but I recognize that common sense isn't as common as it used to be. I sound old, don't I? I am old.
As it relates,
these lights are bright, so I can't see you very well. But
I'm over here. As it relates to the bridge, do you have insight as to the current decision-making process in terms of the bids, and if we're going to make an investment in this new important infrastructure, what confidence do we have that the decisions are going to be well thought through, and that idea of we have to pay for it?
I think there's almost too much attention focused on the bridge and not enough on the system that's in place, one element of which is a bridge which fell down. You see, one solution to the bridge falling down is leave it down. Forget about it. You know, use the other bridges. I got involved in a debate over the Stillwater Bridge. Some of you probably from Stillwater or St. Croix County. And I was one of the speakers, and I said, I've got the perfect solution to the bridge problem of the congestion in downtown Stillwater and all the people and the merchants and the tourists who don't like all that traffic. I said, close the bridge. And there was this dumb silence in the room. I said, well, think about it. There's a perfectly good Interstate 94 bridge just a few miles south. Why not just drive down there? And why should we be subsidizing a bridge for people who are in St. Croix County who are already garnering enormous subsidies as the fastest growing county in Wisconsin? Well, it didn't get very far with that argument because it had already been decided we're going to replace the bridge. And when you push people to say, why should we, then they get kind of mumbly and they're not quite sure. So my response to the question about the bridge to be rebuilt, and seriously, we're going to add 1 million more people to this metropolitan area over the next 30 years. We have to think long and hard. The last slide was about planning. Where are we going to put them? And what difference is it going to make if we put them one place or another place? And while we're thinking about bridges, why not think about roads, and why not think about transit of a different sort? Why not think about walking? Why not think about where we put the new houses and the new commercial and employment opportunities so that we can minimize the amount of walking and driving and bicycling and trucking that we have to do? There's a lot of things that we could do over the next 30 years that would make 2037 a much nicer metropolitan system than we have today. So then the question is, okay, if we're going to do that, who's going to be in charge? Immediately is the question people ask. Well, the answer is we are. We got to put in place a way of thinking about things and a set of institutions that allow us to work out the options and the costs and the benefits and decide who's going to pay what, who's going to use what. And if we do it right and if we're smart enough, we'll get to a better outcome than if we just let everything happen. But it isn't just about a bridge. It's about all of the movement that takes place. Take another example. How do we move sewage? How do we move gasoline and other petroleum products in pipelines? How do we move water? There's a big debate now about whether we should forget about the contaminants that are in the water and just have everybody put a filter on their faucet if they want to take a drink or give the kids a bath. Well, that's an option. Is it a good option compared with having clean water everywhere all the time? The United States is kind of unusual in doing it that way, but that's the way we do it. All of these things need to be paid attention to. And when we have a balkanized metro system of over 600 governments within our commuting field around the Twin Cities, it's a tough job. Last June, Judith and I were at the Metropolitan Council 40th anniversary conference over, where was it, Judith? I don't even remember. It was in one of those grim hotels somewhere around here. And, I'm sure Dante had something to say about hotel design, but we won't go there. One of the most interesting conversations that occurred toward the end of this session was comment from representatives from the counties beyond the seven counties within which the Met Council governs in part and plans in part. They said, what about us? There's a lot going on out in our counties here, and many of the little units of government are overwhelmed by development interests that are trying to build the houses and walk away, leaving behind communities that expected to get certain kinds of services and infrastructure, they're not getting them. Well, how did that happen? What should we do about that? So there was a big discussion about that, and some of the members of the legislature were there, county commissioners and citizens. It was a very interesting conversation. But that's just the tip of the iceberg when you start thinking about where are we heading. 1 million people is a lot of people, and we're going to get them, and we're going to house them, and we're going to allow them to move around, and they're going to be using broken-down infrastructure, schools that need to be rebuilt or replaced. We need to be investing in the people who are going to work in those educational institutions from the early ages up past grade 12, because investing in young people in the right way is what creates what we call human capital, kind of an odd term, but that's the way we talk about it. So people understand how the world works and are ready to take full citizenship within it and contribute to its health. How do we do that? We ought to do a better job of that than we are. In the meantime, we've got all of these other industries trying to grab our money to support what they're doing and telling us, we really think you should do it our way instead of informing us on how we should participate in our own business. One last comment on this, which is one of my favorite, professors talk endlessly, this is a problem. When I was a kid, and when some of you were kids, because there are people in the room my advanced age, when we were kids, many human service professions, in fact, most of them, were highly honored. If you were a teacher, a doctor, a lawyer, taking care of people's needs, what the community gave you was job security, modest income, and high honor, whether you were a judge or anything else. Judges didn't go onto the bench so that they could retire at age 40 as millionaires. They went onto the bench because it was an honor to be a judge.
And you work out your term, and then you had a modest pension afterwards. When we started mixing up market wages with these professions and encouraged the community to claim resources beyond what the material...
I'm wrecking the... system here. What happened in this last 40 years is that each of these professions has, in one way or another, been corrupted. And in the process, that's an outcome of something that's gone on in our society. And it leads to a problem where we're not rebuilding strong institutions as much as we are using institutions to allow people to create careers for themselves that are more self-serving than community-serving. And we stand around and watch this happen without being quite sure what exactly the problem is. We see that here at the university. When the students come here and think when they finish that they didn't quite get what they thought they ought to get. And then sometimes they re-enroll for a postgraduate degree to think they can get a little bit more and go even deeper in debt. And I think there's a problem here. And this is the industry that I know best, but you know as well as I do, the bridge falls down, and how many minutes passed before there were contingency fee litigation specialists down there signing up people for the class action suit? Or we all complain about the healthcare industry and the hospital business when and we get uncomfortable realizing that not only do we spend a lot of money on it, but there's an awful lot of people walking around that aren't in very good shape. What's that all about? And so forth. But, you know, that's another rant for another time. So, other questions? Yes, sir.
Several months ago, we were in Oakland, California, and on television we watched the overpass over one of the interstates collapse.
Right on the East Bay.
And it was the next day they were rerouting the traffic all about. We came home, the bridge over 35W bridge collapsed. Mm-hmm. And they were rerouting the traffic the next day. This week we're in Rockford, Illinois. We're sitting in the middle of a fairly old bridge. The traffic had stopped. The cars were bumper to bumper.
Yeah.
And we hoped that bridge was safe. And I was concerned about that. And I said to myself, I wonder what the chances are that this bridge is going to collapse within the next 5 years from the weight of traffic that's on mm-hmm. it. And I was thinking about that in terms of people... people looking and thinking about bridges. Now, if we knew that there was zero percentage chance of a bridge collapsing in the next 5 years, we'd say, we don't want to touch that. But if we said, okay, we're making an assessment of that bridge, and there's a 70% chance that bridge will collapse over the next 5 years from the traffic that's normally on it, I would think that some people would be concerned about that and would want to pay some tax dollars to get it fixed. So I guess, you know, how do we gather data to make that kind of assessment? And, you know, I know that people are doing that in the state because I read about it.
Yeah, they are.
And how do they gather that data? What are they looking at? And what kind of a overall judgment do they make about when that bridge is going to collapse?
Well, that's an engineering question, and I don't know the answer to that. But I did read a nice piece in the New York Times about 2 weeks after the bridge fell down. It was written by a civil engineer, and he said, the best way to think about these bridges is to compare them with an automobile and think of a bridge as a machine. If the bridge is thought of as a machine and you compare it with a car, then you think about things like, is it getting regular maintenance? Is it being used the way that was intended to be used? And issues of that sort. You don't overload it. I was talking earlier about my Firestone car fix guy. One day I went in there and there was this fairly new little Honda. And I said, well, what's the matter with that car? I was just chewing the fat with the guy because I always learned something. And he said, well, the engine's shot. I said, it's a Honda. They're supposed to, you know, go 200,000 miles. He says, yeah, it's only got 40,000 miles on it, but it's ruined. I said, what happened? He says, well, this guy has a great big boat that he loads up with crud every weekend, and then he drives it at 75 miles an hour up beyond Brainerd, and then he comes back Sunday night, does this all the time, and in 2 years, the engine was shot. This little car with this little engine, he's towing this great big boat. Well, perfect analogy. You can't do that. If you want to do that, you should get one of these big, you know, Ford or Chevy diesel trucks with the big wheels and the big front end that bears down on you from behind when you're on the freeway. But the bridge is the same way. If you build it, as I said, for loads of 40,000-pound trucks going 50 miles an hour, you don't put 80,000-pound trucks on it driving 75 miles an hour. That you just don't do that. So that's one part of it. You kind of use it the way it was intended to be used, and then you have to take care of it. And then at a certain point, if you do take care of it, it'll go on indefinitely. There's no reason why it would ever fall down. But that's the big if, you see. If you cut corners and you say, well, we can wait till one more year before we lubricate the joints and before we repaint it and before we check out this, that, and the other thing, pretty soon you're on thin ice or thin steel or thin something, and it's a problem. But that's an engineer could give you the detailed specifics on that. But if any machine is used the way it's supposed to be used, and it's taken care of properly, it'll last a very long time. You know, go to Italy. There's bridges there that have been used since Roman times, and we don't abuse them. If we did, they'd be gone.
John, there's a question over here.
Yes.
This kind of fits in with what the last gentleman was asking, and kind of with what you're talking about, I think. But it's something that occurred to me while watching the reportage on the night the bridge went down. It occurred to me, what else is about to go? Not necessarily bridges And I think this is what you're talking about, too, is the bridge is kind of a symbol of a lot of things that can go and a lot of things that need maintenance. They don't need steel to shore them up. They don't need concrete. But they certainly need income.
Yes.
And they certainly need attention, and they certainly need to be watched and brought out.
I agree. It's, you know, I think we're repeating ourselves a bit. I like that balance sheet metaphor, and I like the idea of avoiding fictitious budgeting at the state, county, and municipal level. If we pretend that certain costs are not written into the budget, then in effect we're drawing down assets. If you pretend that your roof on your house doesn't need attention, then you're in trouble. And it isn't just the roof. You know, doors wear out, appliances wear out, and so forth. When you ask what's next, you know, when these things happen one at a time, we tend to treat them as isolated events. For instance, the gas line that blew up, was it up in St. Cloud a couple of years or a year and a half ago? We say, oh, the gas blew up. But then if you read into the deep essays that get written about this stuff, you realize that there's pipeline. The country is laced with pipelines, and some of them are well over 50 years old, and a lot of them aren't in very good shape. So how many times does a leakage have to occur and a building blow up before we figure we've got a problem here? I don't know. But it isn't just pipelines moving things. Dams in rivers, which have other side effects. School buildings. Go on down the line. I mean, I'm a geographer. I like to take students into the field and show them things and ask them, what do you see? And then, of course, people see what they're trained to see. And once you tune them in, it's kind of like going to an art museum. If you go with a good docent, they say, well, isn't this a pretty picture? Yeah, but then you sit there and talk about it for half an hour, and all of a sudden you see 50 things you didn't see before, and it takes on a lot of meaning. Our landscapes are the same way. There's a system at work here, and if you know how to look at things and have enough in your head to help figure out how they work, then you can start assessing what's deficient, what needs to be fixed, and so forth. That's about the best I can do on that one.
Professor Adams.
Hi. Hi, Deborah.
It's good to see you again. I want to return to your comment about how we need taxes and more planning. Mm-hmm. In the environmental field, at least, there's complete lack of confidence in the federal and state government. Katrina, the response to Katrina being only the most recent example. And if I believe in taxes, the last thing I would want to do is hand it over to the government. So I'm wondering, first of all, if this is a new sentiment or something that's been building for decades, and if you predict that it will change, because it has to. Reform in the government is necessary.
Well, it's possible that some of these issues which have led to these indictments are in part a bum rap. For example, take the levees in and around New Orleans. When we, in the upper Midwest, farm in areas that lead to excessive topsoil erosion, and that has the effect of changing the delta downstream, and we waterproof more and more of our urban areas so that runoff is much greater and faster than it would otherwise be, because the surface water disappears quickly and the groundwater never gets a chance to get it and slow it down. One of the consequences is that water rushes by New Orleans much faster and in larger volumes than was anticipated when the levees were constructed. Now, one response to that years ago was to build what some of you who have been down there might know of as the Bonnie Carey Spillway, so that when the floodwaters come, they open the gates and send the water directly to the Gulf of Mexico rather than having it go through the levees through the city. If you stop and just think about that dynamic, for instance, did the federal government goof up? Well, there's a lot of players in this that lead to a certain kind of an outcome at a certain place. So is it it's like the
cause and effect in the same time and place. You know, if Chicago gets bigger and that produces consequences for New Orleans, who's to blame? Should we have put growth limits on Chicago? Or could we have planned and built the big cities in such a way that they were more environmentally attuned to the realities of air, water, heat, cold, drainage, etc.? You know, when we first built our cities in the Northeast, what did we do? We built everything close together, and then when rainwater and snow melt pile up in the streets, we created gutters alongside the buildings to carry the water down to the ocean because these towns were built on rivers and water and oceans. Well, then when the city got bigger, we put those drainage channels underground in pipes. And then when we got rid of the privies and put the toilets inside houses and brought in piped water, then we had to get rid of the domestic sewage, so we put that into the now storm sewers that became sanitary sewers and storm sewers, and then we sent all that stuff into the bay. And then pretty soon the bay started to stink so bad, we said, well, we really have to treat this sewage. So year by year, we make accommodations to the world that we find ourselves in. And eventually, of course, as some of you urban types know, we ended up separating the sewer system. So now we have storm sewers and sanitary sewers, and we send the sanitary sewage to the sewage treatment plant. Unless, of course, we get a big rain, and then we just send it all down the river. Who's to blame here? Well, nobody. I mean, I don't blame anybody. I think, to go back to one of our first comments here, when things happen, if they happen at the scale of a metro area, we should sit down and tackle them as metro problems. If it's a neighborhood problem, you know, one of the neighborhoods ends up having a junk house where the yards and the house are full of trash. What do you do about that? That's not a federal government problem. That's a neighborhood problem. Do something about it. Every problem has an appropriate scale at which it can be tackled, but some of these things really are national problems. And for example, if sea level rises to a certain degree, we're going to have hell to pay in some of our coastal cities, parts of which are only few feet above sea level. And when a storm surge comes, as we've seen in the last few years, it's a serious problem. Now, is that a federal problem? I don't know. I don't think so. I think if states that govern the rules of what goes on inside a city fall down on the job and allow things to happen, like many of the things that are going on in South Florida, I find just appalling. But people who like the sun in the winter don't pay any attention to that stuff. But in many respects, parts of Florida and the way it's run, is it's a third world country and has about the same attitudes toward things that you find in some banana republics farther south. That's kind of harsh, but I think it's true. What about that? I don't know the answer, but I do believe in some sort of a principle of subsidiarity, that certain things should be handled at the Fed level, some at the region, some at the state, some at the lower levels. And if we could get that straight with the proper kind of instruction in school about how our country works and the right kind of leadership at the various levels of government, we might actually make some progress. But when we get people in elected office who really don't have a clue about how things work, then we've got another kind of problem on our hands. But we let that happen, as someone over here said earlier.
I'm looking at the income part of it. It seems like we have a federal tax system that really doesn't tax everyone, and we don't have a feeling of community as far as responsibility that the whole country has. We have approximately 136 million tax forms filed. We've got 300 million people. Out of those tax forms, I'm sure a lot of them are married, filed together, and so on. So I'm not sure how many that represents. But out of that 136 million, there's about 40 million of those that pay zero taxes on that or get a credit back by the federal government. So that approximately means 90 million tax forms are paying for the federal government. We're coming up shy. We're in debt. The average person's got $9,000 worth of credit card debt. And then we expect our government to do better than that. They're $9 trillion in debt. We have a system to gather income that doesn't seem to work. We need some solutions, possibly. I don't know. What are your thoughts on a flat tax, a sales tax? If we're such a consumer economy, how about a sales tax instead of a federal income tax? So you don't pay any federal income tax, but you pay it as you buy.
Well, that's too big of a question to answer. Partly it's too big because I actually know something about this. And so You don't want to ask a professor something they know something about, or they'll bend your ear forever. It is the case that figuring out how to tax and spend in this complicated world that we've created for ourselves is nowhere near as simple as it might have been 50 or 100 years ago. In principle, however, there are principles of taxation. You can start, for example, with the aphorism that I threw out earlier, pay for what you get and make sure you get what you pay for. If you start with that, then, of course, you start thinking about what are we doing, going back to Deborah's question about at the Fed level, what should we be doing there? What should we be doing at the state level, county, and down to the lower levels where the rural township is, taking care of the gravel roads and managing the town dump? Well, what's the principle here? If you levy have a tax system that rewards things that you don't want done and penalizes things you would like to see happen, then obviously something's defective. If you have a tax system that's you can't quite figure out how to deploy it because the world has gotten more complicated. For example, a company that is headquartered in Minnesota that does business in China. Well, the Chinese want to tax it, and the Minnesotans want to tax it, and the feds want to tax it. So how do you divide the tax responsibility there? And tax treaties get at that partly. But then, of course, if people are really clever, they lobby Congress for provisions in the Internal Revenue Code so that they can figure out how to shelter income that they should be paying tax to the feds or to the state of Minnesota, and they hire high-priced people, some of whom are probably in the room, to help them figure out how to do that. Well, now, something that's legal isn't necessarily right from the point of view of the ideas that I was mouthing off earlier about. So I don't know the answer to that. I do agree with the point that if we are increasingly involved in a consumer-oriented society, and if it's easy to collect sales taxes, then there's an argument here for paying more attention to it as a revenue generator and as a justifiable tax. But, you get into all sorts of debates here. One of the experiments around the country is to lay off the taxing of income to the extent that we tax it and tax land instead. This is a 19th century idea that in Pittsburgh they're starting to experiment with the last few years. But we go in the opposite direction here. And let me just one anecdote. When those of you who were around when we built the interstate highway system across America, that wherever the roads crossed major highways, that land was immediately endowed with value that it didn't have before because now it was accessible to a degree that previously it had not been. The people who owned the land harvested a major capital gain and rubbed their hands together because God had been good to them and they got this highway routed through their neighborhood rather than the next farm over. A wise move at that time would have been for the federal government and the state government to capture all of that value, tax it all away. Nothing was done by the local to create that value. Therefore, what justification was there aside from inconvenience or whatnot? But that's different from the value of the land. If it goes in the other direction and you plow a highway through somebody's house, as we did in South Minneapolis back in the 50s, then the highway department in the state of Minnesota condemned the houses, eminent domain, paid them not only the house value, but they gave them a premium besides. And then if they wanted, they could buy the house back and move it off to another lot, which many hundreds of people did. So the takings issue was well settled. We know how to deal with that. Nobody ever talks about the givings issue, which is another dimension of what you're talking about here. So this stuff gets pretty complicated pretty quickly. I don't know the answer. I do know that there's a study going on right now through the Department of Revenue to try to figure out how to deal more effectively and appropriately with Minnesota corporations that earn money out of state. How should that be taxed appropriately? No tax is wrong. All tax is wrong. What's the principle you should use for deciding what proportion of income that's earned can be attributed to someplace else rather than to Minnesota? I don't know the answer to that, but people are working on that question right now. And in fact, I heard from somebody over at the state not long ago that there's a rumbling beginning in the state that maybe it's time for another tax study commission to try to think this stuff through for the state of Minnesota along the lines that you just implied and that I've been talking about here. I don't know how that's going to go, but I think it's overdue.
John, one of the things that I was most amazed by when I was a young faculty member was listening to our esteemed, now long-retired colleague, Phil Rupp, talk about the development pattern in the Twin Cities as an agricultural economist would talk about it. And the thing that shocked me was that he was saying in the 1970s, well, Richfield is 25 years old, and in 25 years we'll just have to mow it all down because it was all built at the same time. That hasn't happened because there's been differential investment of various kinds. But one of the things that I think is missing from the conversation about the bridge and the infrastructure that that represents is that an awful lot of this stuff across the country was built at the same time. And the differential levels of maintenance that have come based on where they're located. I mean, we know that the state of Minnesota actually got good marks for high maintenance. So, you know, somebody else asked, you know, what might else fall down? Well, a lot of it could. Because the reality is it's all about the same age, and if these things are not maintained, there is a long-term problem. And I mean we've got about 150 or 180 people here. I think it'd be really nice if coming out of this room tonight, people could have in their minds that we start to talk about investment in what we use and the need to continue to invest going forward.
Well, thank you, Judith. I certainly agree, but the argument that you can attach to this point backs up to another discussion, and that has to do with the post-World War II tradition of subsidizing suburban development. Buying new houses in the suburbs has been a really good deal, and I have a list in another talk I give where I list the 10 major subsidies that flow to new developments out on the edge. Just mention a few of them. For example, everybody knows about the mortgage loan interest deduction. Everybody who owns a house and itemizes their deductions are really happy when they can write that number down and reduce their taxable income by that amount. Same is true with property taxes. The same is true of the way in which we, up until the early 1980s, had two money markets in the United States. Most of you remember savings and loan associations versus commercial banks. Savings and loan associations were in the business of providing money to buy houses, and the feds made sure that if you saved money in a savings and loan, you got a higher interest rate than if you saved money in a commercial bank. That made ensured that money would flow into the housing market and make it available at reasonable prices for people who bought houses. That was a subsidy. You could add also to that the way in which over the years we, for the most part, have financed the capital improvements that delivered utilities to new developments. We didn't charge the new housing development the full marginal cost for telephone, for electric, for gas, and all the other utilities. Instead, we wrote that into the capital base for the utility and then charged the new customer a modest hookup fee. And then they just started paying for what they used. What did that do? It gave people services at a price lower than they would have paid if they had been charged the full marginal cost, and it passed some of that cost on to the old residents in the inner cities who paid more than they should have paid in order that people farther out could pay less. In some states, then you can add all sorts of things like fire departments and police departments and things of that sort, where the old residents pick up more of the tab and the new residents pick up less than a fair share of the tab. Now, about 23 states allow their municipalities to charge what is called development impact fees, where the developers can be charged by a jurisdiction for the off-site services that the new development is going to require: schools, parks, police, fire, and so forth. In many instances, those costs alone, if they're paid for by the new housing owner, could add $20,000 to $30,000 to the cost of the house. By not charging directly for those things, but instead charging the whole community for them, the people buying the new house get a good deal, and the people in the existing houses don't get such a good deal. But the net effect, of course, is to give an unearned capital gain to the people who buy the new house, so new housing is a good deal. So why did, after World War II, did people move out? Well, they wanted new houses. Sure, not a problem. Everybody understands that. But the bad part is they didn't pay for everything they got. That meant that people moved out faster, and in leaving behind the neighborhoods they left behind, where people were forced to pay for prices for things they weren't getting, inner city neighborhoods deteriorated faster than they would otherwise deteriorate, and people who stayed behind became suckers for reinvesting in old neighborhoods, while people who took advantage of the new growth got an extra unearned income. Now, that dynamic just worked. It's worked ever since World War II, and it's not bad. We decided as a matter of national policy that's what we were going to do. But there were big winners and big losers, and by the time we got to the 1960s and early 1970s, we began to see how many of those losers were in concentrated inner-city neighborhoods. And then we had a kind of an urban homesteading system put in place where people tried to push back these things through foundation grants, through modest federal assistance of one sort or another. But the system itself was defective. The system itself, with all of its parts working together, were creating this outcome. So we shouldn't be surprised at what we got. So that works against a place like Richfield, which initially was built up starting in the 1940s in a big way, although it was there before 1940. And it built up very quickly. And then once it was built up, then we worked on Bloomington. When that was built up, then we worked on Apple Valley. Then it's worked up. We drive out 35 south now, and it's all the way out God knows where. What's going on here? People are getting stuff, and they're paying for it. Some people argue, and I argue, that in many instances, they're not paying for everything they're getting. Instead, other people are paying for the benefits, and that makes it a good deal to drive out there, get something, and then commute and expect the roads to be there. So this is a long, complicated tale about how our metro systems work and the rules that are in place to make them work the way they are. But when you try to change those rules, then all the people who are on the beneficiary side say, hey, wait a minute, even talking about capping the mortgage interest deduction or even talking about modifying it for your second house or your second yacht, these rules are pretty generous as to what you can finance with a mortgage loan. You can't do raw land, but you can do structures of many different kinds. These are complicated questions, and the people who don't know what's going on are usually politically less active than the people who do know what's going on and have the resources to protect their gains, whether they are, you know, they're honest because you didn't break any laws, but you've got a defective system there.
This last question was from John's colleague, Professor Judith Martin, and the two of you are co-chairs of the University Metropolitan Consortium.
Consortium, right.
And I wonder if the two of you could just describe briefly here in closing what that's about. Seems like we have a lot to work on, don't we?
Let Judith do it. She's good at this.
The University Metropolitan Consortium is an organization that was created at the level of Vice President for Systems, so it's Robert Jones, under Robert Jones' office. And our charge is to, first off, make some better connections and synergies between and among the many different colleges, institutes, departments, centers at the university that are already doing urban research of various kinds and see if we can encourage them to play together a little bit more and do some more cooperative research. And then secondarily to try and provide a venue in the larger community for discussions of just the sort we're having tonight. We're really seeing this as an opportunity to convene discussions around a number of different themes, and we're focusing on, at the moment, there are three things that we're mainly most interested in. One is transportation. One is the question of planning livable communities, that cluster of issues. And the third one is what John's been talking about, the question of how do we pay for all the things that we're wanting to have and think about that going forward. So,
thanks, Judith.
It's encouraging that we're working on them together. John, you have really exposed us to some pretty mind-bending, complicated issues tonight and done it in such a clear way. I think all of us want to thank you a great deal for doing it.
Thank you.